Hampton Roads, we're back. This is David Allen Carmichael with the Faith and Freedom Show, and we talk about the issues of the day on a constitutional basis. Yes, a biblical basis and the basis of right versus wrong. You got to have a reference, folks. Is there no absolute truth? Well, do you know that absolutely? I don't know. It's a good question. We're talking to Delegate Bob Marshall, and he is a delegate in the Virginia General Assembly. He's a very courageous one, a very hardworking one, and I can tell because I've been watching his legislation over the last few years while we've been doing this radio show. Now, Delegate Marshall, you proposed, and again, I want to tell my listening audience, you need to do something, folks. You know, Mr. Marshall cannot carry this alone. He probably will. He probably will. Well, there's other people working this. I've even talked to people today that are working hard on getting support for this. We've got to retrain the minds. It doesn't matter, Democrat, Republican, Independent, Libertarian, it doesn't matter. We've got to push reset on our reference, folks. There's reality here. We all hear Roe versus Wade, but nobody ever reads it. And then, of course, you don't read the references that they referred to. You know, Mr. Marshall made some good points that the people, like when Jesus showed up in the belly of Mary, and then John leapt in his womb because his Lord's presence, that's a person, a being. In fact, when the Supreme Court in Roe versus Wade, when they referenced Blackstone, it just occurred to me that Blackstone talked about persons with regard to civil rights, but he talked about capital punishment being on somebody who conducts murder, who takes the life of innocent blood, takes innocent blood of any reasonable creature. I see that the person may not be a legal person outside the womb per se, but they're a reasonable creature, and so that killing them, taking the life of innocent blood without due process, is killing a reasonable person. And if a rational person does that, it was always a capital crime because it's
when you think about it, that Barry Lynn guy, sterility was considered a curse in the Old Testament, and that's why, you know, Elizabeth says, "My reproach, you know, Mary's cousin, says, my reproach has been taken away from me." So they would not have been pushing abortion, the ancient Jews. That just would not have been, you know, part of the ethic. Or if somebody had done it, it would have been considered child sacrifice, like those offerings to Moloch, and been roundly condemned.
Yeah, and I was, you know, I got to tell people, if you got nothing better to do, I encourage people to read Blackstone. One of the things he said, he was talking about poisoning, and he talked about the most despicable way of killing somebody is with poisoning, because he went on to say that they're so innocent, so helpless, so defenseless, that is just the most despicable, as one type of killing could be more despicable than another. But I thought that was interesting. Looking back over the last couple of years, I've seen some legislation that I guess that went through, was introduced in 2008, and it was about the viability, some penalty of somebody not making investigation into a viability of a person in the womb before they have given abortion, and some other things. It wasn't necessarily, as I think, just forthright as this new HB 1639 that you've put forth. What was your thinking on those prior years compared to what you're doing this year?
Well, there's two ways to look at this. You either try to accommodate what the Supreme Court allows, or you want to push the court beyond what they're doing, but you need to set up a circumstance legally to provide a new challenge. And so the various efforts are taken. And by us saying if we were able to pass it. And again, I had to oppose the Republican leadership from Bill Howe on down, who's the Republican speaker. They refused to post the vote that I had won on that thing. And I even had to go to a Democrat, the guy who's running for governor, one of the guys running for governor, Brian Moran. I said, "Brian, do you want to have some fun?" And he said, "What?" He said, on the abortion question, he said, "Oh, you and I differ on that." He says, "I may be going to hell." I said, "Brian, you can go to hell in your own time, but when you're here, I want you to help me to send up other people squirming to legislative purgatory on ours." And I said, "Can you help me get a record vote? Because they're going to try to kick this bill off the floor without a record vote." And he says, let me think about it. And I was on a TV show with Brian a couple weeks ago, and he just mentioned, he said, "Oh, that's right." He said he had to get his caucus members to, he said, "Just trust me, believe me, this will work out." And I said, "You think it's good for your side? I think it's just good that we should get this vote." I got a record vote. I got 45, I think, total people in the assembly who took a position on this thing. Now, unfortunately, one of the groups that normally monitor this, the Family Foundation, refused to list it as one of the bills that they score. I don't know why they did that, but, you know, anyway, your listeners can go back and look at that vote and see who was for it and who was against it and make judgments accordingly when they run for office in, 2009.
Well, actually, when I went back to, was that the 2008 legislative session? I looked for this bill. I mean, with these express, words, it's very short and sweet, right to the point.
Right.
Single object rule fulfilled. It's beautiful. But I didn't see this anywhere in the 2008...
On, you look in... legislative information.
Just for information, I've got the pre-filed December 10th version that was just pre-filed last month by you.
Right. Those are the bills that we're... Well, there's another ridiculous thing. We only have, 15 bills we can put in.
Right.
Even though we,
Well, I'm kind of for that. You can tell I've read Blackstone, so I'm saying, well, the less innovations, the better, right?
Except to undo laws, you have to introduce a law.
Yes.
So, I've got the largest legislative district in the House of Delegates in the state of Virginia, bigger than some Senate districts. The Senate has no limit on the number of bills they can put in.
Hmm.
And in the Virginia Constitution, it says you may not restrict a person from petitioning for redress of the grievance. But
that's
since
true.
I, as an agent of my, people, if I can't put in a bill to address a problem, you're really kind of crowding them out.
That's true. You're cutting out our founders in Virginia considered the most important branch of the government. That's a good point.
That's correct.
Good point.
Maybe it's 2007, but I did put it in, and I got all these. I'll look at the screen while you're going to ask me more questions.
Well, that's the 2007, and I'm going to kind of wrap this up on this conversation. But, folks, I want you to think about that. Guess what? Let's see. Next week, according to Code of Virginia 57-2.01, yes, I've got it memorized. Sad but true. It's Virginia Freedom Celebration Week is next week. Now, the week after that is the anniversary of the Roe versus Wade issue. Folks, this is important. If you think that it's okay, and even you say, well, what about in case of incest or rape? Well, even if you can't agree on the biblical thing, well, the Old Testament says you're not supposed to punish the child for the father's sin. Now, whether that gets carried down by divine intervention, that's another thing. But us men, we don't have that authority to hold a baby accountable for the sin of the father. We just don't have it. And, oh, by the way, if you read the U.S. Constitution, it talks about capital crime of treason, and it requires two or more witnesses to prove, because guess what? Even if somebody does something wrong and earns death, if we can't prove it by the best means we have available to prove that somebody is really guilty and needs to be put to death, guess what? We don't have the authority to do it. So whether it's rape or incest, well, it's very difficult to prove that it would, it's a long story. We do not carry the crime of the father down to the children. That's called, what did they call it in the U.S. Constitution? Called the corruption of blood. And that's essentially what it was. So, folks,
that's right, where you hold B guilty for the sins of A.
That's right. And that's what it would be under the case of rape and incest. Our goal is, and again, we go back to our founders were reading the, when I say Blackstone, our founders were actually reading this stuff. And one of they said was, it's the purpose of government to protect the meanest individual from the stronger individual. And obviously the word meanest was a little weak one. Now, do you have any other comments to finish up on that legislation before I go on to the next thing I was going to talk to you about?
No, other than if your listeners can call their delegates and ask them to co-patron the measure, it would be a very big help.
And you've got that website in front of you. I think it sounds like you were looking up the legislative information system.
The other one was 2007 when I did the other bill. I think it was House Bill 2697. I did get a record vote. You can find it there.
Okay, good. I'll look that up. Folks, you can go on a search engine, and you can look up Virginia statutes. And they'll tell you about the Virginia Legislative Information System. And when that comes up, there will be two things that will come up. It'll say the big header, 2009 session, and then it'll have some other kind of lower categories underneath that. Don't go to the lower category because it'll take you back to 2008. Those links haven't been updated. Go to where it says 2009 session, and you can type in, and they'll be listed by member and all this kind of stuff. You can find out who your delegate is just by going to that legislative information system by typing in Virginia statutes or Virginia legislature, and you can find that. Okay, what I wanted to talk about next is we've got, again, trying to avert any dangerous innovation. Mr. Marshall, my hero, he didn't even talk to me. He didn't even know this was one of my pet peeves, is the Real ID Act. Can you explain to our listeners what the Real ID Act is?
Okay, well, this was a statute passed by Congress in 2005. It was an amendment to the Appropriations Act that was funding the Iraq War and the Tsunami Relief Fund. So here you have an act that's supposed to pay for the funding of government, and you mentioned a single object rule. They don't have that in Congress. You can have 48 objects to one bill. It's called log rolling up. That's a very dangerous thing. And they added this provision for what they thought was an attempt to identify people for federal purposes. Specifically, they mentioned boarding an airplane, going into a federal building, and then they said for other federal or for any federal purpose left undefined. The thinking behind it was, when all these guys got these fake ID or these IDs and used the driver's license to get on airplanes, that this would somehow kind of help the authorities prevent this. Big problem, however. There were no hearings on this bill. The first hearing on this bill came in 2007. The second hearing came in a Senate subcommittee in 2008. So this wasn't really vetted as to its consequences. In other words, you've got to, there's something that a bill says, and there's something that a bill means, and then there's something that the things that it implies or that you can infer out of this that you may not think of when it first passes. But if the words are there, really, the judges are supposed to leave it alone, and the bureaucrats are supposed to administer it, so they're kind of stuck. But what happened is this, quote, Real ID Act, and again, to show you that it's not necessarily the accurate point, I just read the 138 single-space pages of the regulations of the Federal Real ID Act, which came out, I guess, in January of 2008. And they do acknowledge in there that it would have been probably one or two of the terrorists who boarded those airplanes in September 2001 whose name would have, they would not have been allowed to have a license at that time. But remember, it was two of those four on the one airplane, so two of the guys would have still gone on. And the fact that you have the identity, some of these people were on a terror watch, but nobody was looking at it. For this to be effective, you have to have a known list, a valid list, an exhaustive list of terrorists. If you don't have that, you can identify somebody down to the, you know, gene level, and it doesn't help you. And in fact, the only episode after that where there was a serious event on an airplane of that Reed guy coming from England or France to the United States, he had proper identification. He had a British passport, and he was properly identified, and he was, you know, trying to light his shoe to blow himself up and everybody else. So the identity, while helpful, it is not really the most critical part. It's the sniffing dogs, it's the chemical detection devices, it's the people that you have to frisk, gotta take your shoes off. That's what gives the safety, and even at least of the same importance, if not more, the baggage handlers. I mean, if some guy slips in there with a bad background and puts a bomb on a plane, you're not gonna find out for a long time, especially if it's a Mid-Atlantic flight. So I don't necessarily fault the intent, but the way this has been put out is the problem, because what they do with the act, they put the minimum items, in other words, they put a floor on what information the act wants you to collect. They don't put a ceiling. And this has caused some concern that this might be the beginning of a national identity card, which I guess if you want to go back to the Old Testament, is that point of numbering people. You know, we have a census and we number people just for purposes of determining, you know, representation. But this comes in, and I got the Libertarian Party from down in Tidewater. I got the ACLU. I got moderate, you know, people and conservatives just all over the ballpark who are concerned about where this thing can go. Moreover, the cost of this is quite huge. It's at least $11 billion for all 50 states to do this. And supposedly the kicker here was if you don't have a real ID, then you can't use your regular driver's license to get on an airplane or go in a federal building or a nuclear facility. Then you say, what? I can't get on an airplane? No, you read the regulations more. If you have a passport, you've already gone through their identification threshold checks, so you'll still get on an airplane. So it makes me a little more suspicious why they're doing this when they acknowledge you still get on the plane.
Well, I'm going to bring up a little trivia that most people don't know about. There was we know about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and that was a federal act. And in Bernie versus Flores in Texas, they said, well, you can't really implement that on the states because there's a little constitutional boundary here, boundary for powers, separation of powers. So what happened is Virginia just last year, thank you, I don't know what you voted on that, but I appreciate you guys putting together the Religious Freedom Protected in Virginia because it basically parallels that. Well, what happened was, in fact, what started the cascade toward government intruding on religious freedom was actually an SSN identification case in the Supreme Court, Bowen versus Roy, back, I think it was 1984, 86. But one of the things that I've seen in many cases, in Virginia specifically and other places, parts of the country, there are certain people with religious, they may have, some religious people don't like, you know, their face scanned. Maybe some don't like pictures, some don't like scanning. Yeah, some don't. Yeah, and it might be scanning, it might be a picture, depending on the their background. Retina scans, DNA, you know, whatever it might be, thumbprints.
Right.
And some people have an aversion to the universal use of an SSN as an identification number. Well, it turns out, to get a passport, if you have a religious prohibition, and there's, if you read the back of a passport, it's draconian. You shall not get a passport without giving an SSN, no matter what. And it cites,
right.
You know. But when you actually go to the State Department and say, hey, I've got this religious problem here with this rule. Could I please have a passport? They say, sure, no problem. Just go ahead and we can see that it is true. You're not making this up. And they verify you. They get other information. You got a passport. But what
right.
the state does, the state says, oh, look at this federal welfare mandate. Section 666 of the Health and Human Services Code requires the states to ask for a SSN. And they call that a mandate. Well, that's
wait,
funny.
Wait, stop. It really is 666?
Oh, you didn't know that. It's Title 42, Section 666, Paragraph A13.
I haven't memorized the federal code, correct?
Well, when it says 666 and it relates to this universal number, it just kind of sticks in your mind, you know. So, but there is a waiver. The secretary can make a waiver. It's like Paragraph D. But he hasn't done that yet. He hasn't said anything. He's just kept quiet. Well, same thing with passports. There's a waiver provision, Paragraph E, but the secretary had never made any determination. But under American law, it makes sense if God says don't do this, and the government says, okay, if you obey God, we're going to cause you to suffer, that doesn't equate. But what I've seen throughout the nation over the 666 issue is that the states are calling that, it's an administrative convenience, it's a mandate suddenly, because there's, you know, the federal government says it. So there is, as I see this Real ID thing, they're going to look, and if you look at the Real ID, there is, I couldn't see when it first came out, it was 2005, I saw no imposition on the states at all. It said, if a person wants to receive this federal benefit, their identification must conform with these rules. It was just like House Bill 3202. You left, you know, when you passed it, the locality could say, well, we don't want to implement it. But then the mayor said, look what the legislature has forced upon us. It's sophistry. It's not true. And so what you do is we see this wave of power rushing along, and bless our hearts, we've got these constitutions, and we're just kind of asleep at the helm until we have people like Delegate Robert G. Marshall who are there doing the hard work to kind of stem the tide, so I appreciate that. But that's what I see about the Real ID, is it's, like you said, it had a floor. I think initially it had a biometric requirement, and then they dropped that. Are you familiar with all those requirements?
In the regulations, they don't have, at least now, those kind of really intrusive points. But again, the Act, in other words, it says this is a minimum for the information that has to be collected. It's not a ceiling. So it causes people problems. Now, what you do have to do, you're supposed to do to comply here, every DMV, you're going to get in line, you're going to give them, again, we do some of this now, but it's not as time-consuming as what the feds want us to do. We ask for a birth certificate for identification purposes. We'll ask for backup things if you can't have that, but the birth certificate is the preferred and first. They also want a Social Security number, and the feds don't want the license issued without the Social Security number being verified completely. Well, that's going to take quite a while for the Social Security Administration to tell, you know, Sally Smith, who works at the DMV in Virginia Beach, yes, indeed, you know, Darryl Jones, is this is his number. And so that means is you're going to have to go to a centralized system for issuing the licenses, and you're supposed to keep a hard copy and an electronic file copy of the birth certificate. In other words, if you're born in Iowa, you're getting a driver's license in Virginia, you've got to write to the state of Iowa, bring the birth certificate with you, give proof of your Social Security number, a W-2, and some other documents. The DMV now is going to scan that. Now, you're not going to get your license right away. They're going to scan that, and then when you're driving in Illinois and you get stopped, the guy is going to go and say, well, is this a real license? I mean, right now, if you're stopped, the police, in other words, there's a network which allows each state to connect. But you don't have to go back to the original documents. If you then want to go get a new license, Illinois is going to come up and say, okay, Darryl, you got your license in Virginia, your birth certificate's from Iowa. Virginia's supposed to have on record all these documents. But now, question is, who's going to have access to those documents when you're not looking? And therefore, your birth certificate, which you normally, I mean, like, look at all the flap that went on with Obama's birth certificate. When people try to get a copy, they said, no, only the person who has a direct interest in this can get it. So, you know, that's where we are with this.
Well, I appreciate, those are privacy concerns. I think America, if we would stop and think about, you know, the 1940s, let's not forget, show me your papers. So, we can see historically where, and we're going to be taking a break here shortly, but when we come back, I'm going to talk about some other legislation that goes very absolutely opposite to your anti-real ID legislation. I noticed that Senator Cuccinelli's bill listed pretty carefully, it's a Senate bill, fingerprints, palm prints, behavior characteristics, handwritten signature. I will tell you that there is an interest to those who are of the Christian persuasion when they were taught about an eventuality when you couldn't be doing anything without giving a number or a mark on your right hand forehead or whatever it might be. So, and I will just say that increasingly our government and the state has always been contrary to the person who would claim a duty of religion. When we come back, what we're going to do is I'm going to bring up two House bills that go just actually contradicting Delegate Marshall's bill and some of his intent for that. So we'll be back.